Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Memorial Day Sale and get 30% off paints and stains May 15th through the 28th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
What or who was the original algorithm?
How did assassins really get their name?
And why does English use Arabic numerals?
From cotton and candy to sugar and saffron, we'll explore the algebra and alchemy of Arabic words in English in this episode of Words Unraveled.
Welcome to another Words Unraveled. I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words.
And I'm Jess Zafaris, author of etymology books, including Useless Etymology. And today we are here to talk about Arabic words in English with a dash of Persian as well, right?
Absolutely. I have to make a confession here. This is a bit of a blind spot for me. Actually, Arabic is a huge blind spot for me. I've never studied it. All that I'm going to say here that I say with any authority is information that I've found while researching this subject. It's not off the top of my head stuff generally, but Jess, you have studied a bit of Arabic, so I'm going to need your help.
I'm by no means an expert either, and I expect and hope to be corrected a good bit here, but I minored in Arabic language in my undergraduate degree, and I spent some time in Morocco studying modern standard Arabic. So although I can't possibly hold a functional conversation beyond saying, yes, I studied Arabic in Morocco, no, I don't understand what you're saying. I do know, I can read the letters on the page and recognize some of them.
My understanding is that Morocco is about the worst place you could learn Arabic, right? Because weirdly, Arabic has got dozens and dozens of dialects. They're not all necessarily even mutually intelligible, but Moroccan is reputedly the furthest away from the rest of them, right?
I was in an area where they were speaking, where your average person spoke Darija. They also spoke French and they could understand modern standard Arabic. So I got around town while learning modern standard Arabic from Jordanian teachers. Jordanian and Syrian teachers, I got around by speaking as many Arabic words as I could in modern standard Arabic and filling in the gaps with French, which I knew just a little bit more of. And everyone found that hilarious, but they did understand what I was saying. I didn't understand what they were saying, though.
We should explain modern standard Arabic is, it's sort of an invented version of Arabic that draws upon aspects of all of them, right? Meaning that it can be understood wherever you are in the Arab speaking world, right? But no person has it as their native language, really, do they?
You can find much of Islam communicated in modern standard Arabic. It's sort of the most classical form.
Similar to classical Arabic, right?
Which mm-hmm. It is a modern adaptation of classical Arabic.
Gotcha.
It is, I think, one of the most useful global languages to learn if you wish to engage in a global capacity, because almost anyone from an Arabic-speaking country will probably at least understand what you're going for, right? It's also very easy to learn. It is a mathematical language that makes a lot of sense, and you can learn almost the entire language by memorizing what these triliteral or triconsonantal roots, which is three core consonants that provide a fundamental meaning, and you add vowels and prefixes and suffixes to those consonants and diacriticals and things to make a ton of other words. Like katab is the triliteral root meaning writing, and it gives you words like kataba, meaning he wrote, or kitab, meaning book, or maktab, meaning office. you have all of the world based on these concepts. And you know, we kind of do the same with Latin roots, but by no means in a consistent way.
Those three consonants set the tone. They tell you what the theme is, and then you build vowels around them. We should mention that there's something interesting, or at least to us, going on with consonants and vowels in written Arabic, insofar as you do not write the vowels in written Arabic.
In most cases.
Okay, caveat right there.
The A at the front of the definite article, it's a vowel. And then there's this other, yes, in most cases. But another example, just to give you the idea of the triliteral or triconsonantal root, is darasa is studying or learning. So darasa is he studied, daras is lesson, or dars is lesson. Please forgive my pronunciation, everyone who speaks Arabic.
Well, what I'm hoping is that if there are so many different dialects, that if you pronounce it however you like, everyone's just going to think you're pronouncing it in one of the other dialects.
Hopefully.
And so you'll get away with it.
Yeah, well.
That's what I'm relying on.
Ignorant white lady with this much knowledge talking about this much information.
Let's do what we do best, though. Let's talk etymology, get into some words that are in English that come from Arabic. You talked about the vowel sound at the start of the definite article, that al sound, as it tends to come out as the definite article. We have a lot of words that still have that Arabic definite article sitting at the top.
Like alcove, algorithm, algebra, almanac, albacore, alfalfa, alcove.
Well, don't just list them all, Jess. Tell us about them.
Well, yeah, now we're getting them.
A lot of those are to do with chemistry.
A lot of the words that we get in English from Arabic are through sciences, especially math and chemistry. In fact, the word chemistry is probably from a Greek name for Egypt because of Alexandrian chemistry, which was going on there. Ultimately, it started as the discipline of alchemy, which sounds more mystical now, but wasn't as mystical initially. And eventually that word became chemistry. But the Greek word here probably means it's alchemia, probably means something like it's an Arabic adaptation of a Greek word meaning land of black earth or something, which meant Egypt.
That word comes to mean a science of trying to turn base metals into gold, doesn't it? Which is when we talk about alchemy. It does mean that in English for a while as well, although it does have this sort of broader chemistry meaning. But there are also related words to alchemy that also have this definite article in them. I'm thinking of elixir, because part of alchemy is also finding the elixir that enables this transmutation of base metals into gold. And that, again, is elixir, which is probably actually, it's the definite article. And then the ixir bit is perhaps from Greek, a Greek word meaning a desiccative powder for wounds. That's how the OED has described it. So yeah, but a sort of healing powder.
Our notion of alcohol is also a powder, essentially. So it's from al-kul, literally the coal, which is a fine metallic powder that was originally used to darken the eyelids. We still call coal that stuff that you can use as eyeliner.
K-O-H-L, coal, rather than C-O-A-L, even though they're both dark powders.
The substance was originally powdered antimony, which is also a word that's most likely from Arabic, but was mangled totally beyond recognition in Greek and Latin. Like, it doesn't contain any word element that looks like anti or moni in Latin or Greek or modern English, but was a mangling of a word like al-othmud or something like that. Alcohol originally referred to distilled substances like antimony that were used in cosmetics, but then evolved to describe any distilled substance, and then was narrowed down into distilled strong liquors and then any alcoholic substance.
And then another chemical one is alkali as well, which is a little bit more obvious. I don't know. To me, that just seems like it could have come from Arabic, and it does. It's from alkali, or, I mean, how do you pronounce the Q? It's a sound that's a bit unlike.
Throw it farther in the back. It is closer to our Q sound, like the deepest you can make that K, K, K.
Okay.
In your back of your throat.
Kali. I'm working on it. Anyway, it meant the soda or the ash. And originally an alkali was a salty substance, but now it's a base that can be dissolved in water.
That is also ultimately why we use the symbol K for potassium, because it comes from the Latin kalium, meaning potash, from the Arabic al-kali, meaning the ashes or the burnt ashes.
That's a beautiful one, Jess. Love that.
We also get words like borax, ultimately, from Arabic, which that was a surprise to me. This is probably very ignorant of me, but I kind of assumed borax sounded brand namey.
What is it? It sounds like a Pokemon to me.
The word first shows up in the 14th century as a name for useful minerals, specifically a salt formed from the union of boracic acid and soda. I think borax is something like that now. It is a cleaning thing. I think you use it in laundry and things, like the multi-purpose cleaner, and it can be an odor controller. I'm well outside of my area of expertise here, so.
I don't know the differences between all the different sodas. I don't know my baking soda from my bicarbonate of soda. Don't ever eat a cake that I've made, for goodness sake. So we're going to start separating them out into borax as well. We're in trouble.
Uh-huh. But this word is originally from the Arabic buraq. Well, actually, it's probably ultimately Persian. And this might be a good time to point out that we are seeing a good bit of Persian in here. And although they share the same script and a good chunk of vocabulary, Persian and Arabic are from different language families, which is interesting, right? And a lot of Persian words ended up in English because Persian became a prestige language in areas where Arabic was originally spoken and the predominant language.
Geography is everything when it comes to these languages, and the fact that they sit at a key position between the East and the West would be a very reductive way to put it, but between Asia and Europe in particular. So a lot of trade goes via Persia, which means we get a lot of terms associated with trade via there. A lot of products end up with Persian or Arabic names. In fact, let's talk about some of those, because they're really big ones when it comes to borrowings from Arabic. I mean, cotton, for example, a word from Arabic, which you look at it and I would never have guessed that it was an Arabic word, because I don't associate it necessarily with Arabia, even though that is where it is being produced when it first comes into Europe. And that is precisely why we get that word. But it's from the Arabic. You've got to do that thing about that cotton. Enters English in Middle English. So it enters it in the 12th century. So the Crusades, you know, are still cracking off. There's a lot of Europeans heading down to Arabia and to the Middle East for the purposes of fighting for Christianity. But in Middle English, it is cotton. And what it originally means is not the fabric itself in English, but it means a padding made from it that you put underneath your suit of armor, which is really cool.
Isn't that similar to bombast in English?
There is another name for it actually in English, and it's acton. Acton is another name for the padding underneath your chainmail or underneath your suit of armor. But acton is actually from exactly the same source as cotton, but the a at the start is from the Arabic definite article. So it's cotton is from cotton. Sorry, pronunciation wrong. Acton is from al-cotton.
Another interesting one here is ultimately we call tabby cats. You have a tabby cat, right?
I do.
Are you a cat with
anyone? She's on the balcony. Vasilisa, well, yes.
She is called tabby. Her coat pattern is called tabby, ultimately due to an Arabic word. There was a striped silk taffeta, also called tabby, which came via French from the name of a Baghdad neighborhood called Atabi, where rich silks were made. And taffeta is also a Persian word for silk or linen cloth. It literally means like spun or woven. Until the 1770s, it was really uncommon to hear the English word tabby used on its own to refer to a feline. Most people were still using the full phrase tabby cat. And evidently the word tabby was also used to refer to female cats in particular, similar like Tabby and Tom, in association with the woman's name Tabitha, which helped popularize it as a word for cat stuff.
Oh, sure. So you got Tom and Tabitha. That's sweet. So tabby comes from, sorry, a tabby, did you say this? Mm-hmm. It comes from a place.
A neighborhood where rich silks were made, particularly this stripy pattern.
We're talking about commodities brought via Arabia through trade. Spices are a good one. Saffron, for example, which is mostly used as a dye nowadays, but that's, again, from Arabic, zafaran, which is what it is. It's crushed stigmas of a flower that give this orangey red color. In fact,
crocus,
before we had
right?
the word orange, yes, crocus, exactly, yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. Before we have oranges, and therefore we use that the word for that fruit as our color, one of the words we're using for that hue is saffron, because we're comparing it with something else we know that is sort of that color.
Yes, and I'm glad you mentioned orange, because that also is, it's originally from Sanskrit and then traveled through Persian, Arabic, Italian, and medieval Latin, and then French. And it's often said that, we've talked about this before, it's often said that an orange was originally a norange, but it wasn't ever that in English. It was naranja, and in other languages, it was naranj in Arabic, it was narang in Persian, but the N was dropped before it even came close to hitting English.
Yeah, I think one of the likely suspects is Italian, un'arancia.
Narancia became arancia.
Yeah, exactly, which makes more sense. I mean, it could have happened in English, but it didn't. It happened somewhere else.
Even in medieval Latin, it was pomum de orange, which is apple of orange.
Well, this is a funny thing, though, because there is a place in France called Orange. People have heard of William of Orange. But actually, the names are not related, but their spellings are influenced by one another. Presumably, there is a sort of folk etymology idea going around that these apples come from this part of France, which is why they're sometimes being called apple of orange. But actually, orange is only called that. Well, anyway, you've got my point.
There's a funny journey that apricots went on. It's very much a Latin word, but it traveled through Arabic and then turned into apricot. So apricots are literally pre-cooked. Their name is ultimately from the Latin precocum, meaning early ripening fruit. So it's related to the word precocious. Children who are precocious are pre-cooked.
Oh, yeah. You taught me that. I love that one.
Yeah. But the Latin word traveled through Arabic, albarcuc, as a word for a plum, and then Catalan before it made its way into English as abricoc, and then became, in fact, in Midsummer Night's Dream, there's the line, feed him with apricocks and dewberries. And so it's a precocious fruit. Plums and apricots are precocious fruits because they have a habit of growing early when frost is still a risk.
So here's an interesting thing. Aubergine means the apricot.
Yes.
Did you know this? So we've got a vegetable named after a fruit.
Sugars and candies all come from Arabic. Sugar and candy might have reached English via Arabic, sukkar and kandi, but their sweetness ultimately is rooted in Sanskrit. Candy traveled through Persian as khand, which is a word for cane sugar, and then Arabic kandi, which became part of the old French phrase sucre kandi, sugar candy, before it entering English in the 13th century. And it was a big deal when it was introduced in Britain from the Middle East by returnees from the Crusades a couple centuries earlier, because English had an enormous sweet tooth, as it turned out. And by the 1700s, between that period and the 1700s, the construction of domestic sugar refineries made English one of the largest industrial producers of sugary goods in the entire world.
And it was always sugar candy as a sort of compound to start with. And then eventually we dropped the sugar. And mm-hmm. In America, you had particular enthusiasm for that word. But we, over here in Britain, we stuck with sweets, which was an even older word for sweet things.
The English sugar was Portuguese imported treacle, and then brown sugar, and then later refined white sugar, depending on the price point, with like the age of colonization and whatnot.
The g sound in English sugar is an anomaly. No one knows why we've got a g sound. All the other words for sugar, it's a k sound in the middle there. But for some reason, it became a g from the French word that before had, so was we know French for sugar is sucre, right? It's a k sound, but it got softened to a g. But there is a precedent for it because the French flacon became flagon in English. So there's something, for some reason, we get a bit lazy sometimes with a k sound and we sort of soften it to a g sound. You mentioned that the Spanish for sugar is azúcar. Mm-hmm. Or azúcar, I don't know how you say it in the Americas, but it's azúcar in Iberian Spanish. So the ad, the starter there, once again, we've got the definite article from Arabic rearing its beautiful head.
You mentioned that the like G sounds, it is also common for that K sound to be rendered in English when you're trying to transliterate Arabic, as it can be a G, it can be a K. There's a R sound that's more like the French R sound that can sometimes be rendered as a G sound as well in English.
But even the word Quran is sometimes transliterated into English with a Q or a K, isn't it? There's no consistency on that.
We've mentioned that Arabic and Persian are from different language families, right? Persian is in the same, is an Indo-European language like English. Arabic is an Indo-Iranian language, an anti-Semitic language.
Isn't that confusing that Persian is not an Indo-Iranian language, given that Persia and Iran, that?
There are a few different, like some of the distinctions involve core grammatical structure and origin that are distinct from Indo-European in Persian. And thanks to, there's a lot of intermingling because of the vocabulary, because of the alphabet and a couple other things. But there are a few additional letters in the Persian alphabet that are not present in Arabic. And something interesting happens here because there's no P sound in Arabic, but there is in Persian. P sounds in Arabic are often replaced with B or F sounds, which is also cool because that happens from Indo-European roots into Indo-European modern words as well. But the biggest and coolest example of that, I think, is that the word Fars is originally the Arabic name for Pars, the name of the region in Iran where modern Persian evolved, which is also called Persis in Greek. So Farsi and Persian, which are the same language, are also kind of the same word.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I really like right? that. Another one that's become quite pertinent recently is the fact that Palestine is not spelt with a p sound. It doesn't have a p sound in Arabic. It has a f sound in Arabic.
Which would connect it to the word Philistine, right?
Would you actually pronounce it Philistine, not Philistine?
That's what they said when I was in church as a kid.
Really? I genuinely never heard another human say it like that.
Okay.
You've just opened up a world to me. I've been a Philistine when it comes to the pronunciation of Philistine.
Let's get back to some of the word origins.
We haven't talked about coffee yet. The Europeans more or less all take it from Turkish, kahve, but it's probably enters Turkish from Arabic, pronounced kafa, something like that, with that k sound at the start, with the q sound
kahwa
at the start.
In Arabic.
Kahwa. Mm-hmm. Oh, right. Okay. So the W is pronounced like a W. Okay. Sorry. Mm-hmm.
It's an oo sound that sometimes does a wa.
Kahwa. Kahwa. Okay. So that's quite far off, isn't it? Word thought to have originally meant wine. And then when alcohol became no longer acceptable because of religious tenet, then the next stimulant, which was this drink made from beans of a plant that was not called the coffee plant. It had a completely different name, but starts being called by the name that previously wine was being called by. And then the Turks go absolutely crazy for coffee. and their word is as close to cafe as you need it to be, really, because that's why the word coffee in many, many European languages does sound a lot like cafe. It probably goes to Italy first and then gets everywhere else, and then France spreads it a lot. But the weird thing that's going on with English is that we've got that oh sound, or ah sound if you're speaking general American, coffee, which is weird and you know, not easily explained. It's thought that maybe the Brits picked up the word coffee from a specific dialect of Ottoman Turk where that oh sound was there, but it didn't get it from the place that everyone else got the word coffee, that's for sure. And so, for example, the Dutch word for coffee is basically coffee, but it's thought that they must have got that from the English.
How caffeinating.
We should mention another theory that does do the rounds, and that seems very plausible, which is that coffee gets its name from a place in Ethiopia called Kaffa, where coffee has been grown for an awful long time. But that idea is completely divorced from and not really compatible with the Arabic etymology and the idea that it comes from this word meaning wine. So it seems like the people who know what they're talking about favor the Arabic idea over the Ethiopian mountain region idea, but they're both worth a mention.
Yeah, absolutely. And you could see how either could be plausible, and it just traveled through one way or another. It's like, although chai and tea have variations in almost every other language, it's debated where exactly English borrowed the word chai from, and one idea is from Arabic and one idea is from Russian, and there are a bunch of others, but like it's the same word in most languages.
Do we briefly mention the whole tea chai thing and the fact that, you know, countries that got it via the trade routes over the sea tend to call it tea or something similar, uh-huh. And those that got it via the Silk Road, so overland, which would be via Persia, tend to call it something like chai.
It's kind of a neologism, but wanderwort is what they call it. It's like a wandering word because it has variations all over the world.
Vandervoort. All the best linguistic terms are German.
Another one is rose, actually, which is probably from an Iranian root, but we got it from Greek ultimately via Latin, via Norman, via Middle English. It's the Greek rhodon is probably from an Iranian root.
I do worry that if we'd called it by any other name, it wouldn't smell as sweet, though.
Ha, 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 ha. Oh, beautiful.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Etymologically, coffee, tea, these are really big hitters. People like to tell these stories. I enjoy telling these stories. Another one that people like to tell the story of is assassin. We should go into assassin because it's relevant.
Yes. Oh, this is a good one. The word literally means hashish user, sort of. So this is the part that people get hung up on because there is a big sort of there. So hashishin, the order of assassins, and assassins alone are Western European names for the Nizari Ismaili state, which is a sect of Shia Muslims who lived in a network of mountain strongholds across Persia and Syria from the 11th to the 13th centuries. Because they were surrounded by enemies, they established a reputation for employing tactics like psychological warfare and covert murders or assassinations of rival leaders. The founder of the sect reportedly called his followers assassiyun, meaning the principled people or the people who are faithful to the foundation of the faith. In the 12th century, a Fatimid caliph derogatorily referred to them as hashishi, meaning hashish users. He was later assassinated by Nizari agents, some of the people he was sort of mocking.
So is it a pun?
Kinda.
Does that make it a pun?
Yeah, kinda. Kinda. It's sort of like an appropriated insult in some ways.
Yeah.
But crusaders and other Western Europeans blended this information into a claim that the Nizari were called hashishin because they carried out assassinations after smoking or consuming hashish. And Marco Polo notably journaled about that process in the 13th century, and he described a young man who was put into a trance by a potion made from hashish and sent to assassinate a target. Beyond these stories, there's no really historical evidence that they used hashish at all, and especially not that they were involved in any ritual assassinations. But nonetheless, the word traveled to Europe through these stories. So it does kind of mean that, but also super doesn't.
And you can link those words assassin and hashish. You just can, because the form that it takes in English, assassin, is informed by the word hashish.
It's not from that word, but it is definitely involved.
Exactly. So it's okay. Because I, you know, this is a revisionist thing going on with assassin, the etymology of that, in our small little circles, where it's no longer fashionable to say it's linked to hashish, but it is. Right. It is.
Definitely part of the story that made the word what it is today.
Precisely.
One that you wouldn't expect, which also involves a little bit of like folk etymology shenaniganing, is the word fanfare, which is from Arabic.
No way.
This is the best idea we have, is that it is from the Arabic farfar, meaning chatterer, and it's like an imitative word. And then it entered Italian as fanfano and Spanish as fanfaron, meaning braggart. Originally, this was like someone who was boastful. And so a fanfare of trumpets originally became like a loud, boastful sound. It was, of course, conflated with words like ban and fair, right? But there's also, if you think about it, if you break down the word logically, like, sure, fan makes sense in the context of that word, but there's no reason that fair should mean a big, loud sound in English.
Unless it's like all the fun of the fair and all of the noise of it.
That's why we think of it as being like a loud celebratory sound. It made sense, even though it has nothing to do with fan or fairs.
So that's a rationalization of a word from elsewhere. We've gone, okay, well, let's just approximate that sound with fan and that sound with fair.
Another cool one is amalgam. Which you wouldn't necessarily expect to be Arabic, and had a way more specific meaning originally. Even in English in the 1400s, it was a blend of mercury with another metal or any soft mass formed by chemical manipulation. And ultimately, it is an Arabic word, al-malgam, a poultice or an unguent for sores that was especially warm. It was an alchemist's term.
That was a word I was trying to think of earlier when we were talking about elixir. Because it sounds like an elixir was basically a poultice, a sort of powder that you apply to help healing.
I should say the Arabic word might also have been influenced by a Greek word for a softening substance. So it might not originally be from Arabic root-wise, but it was introduced to English thanks to Arabic alchemy.
Yeah, we shouldn't play down the Greek involvement in this. It's almost a sort of love triangle with the Persian and the Arabic, really, because they're also being influenced by the Europeans too in that respect.
Yeah, I mean, think about how knowledge would travel between like Alexandria and Persia and Greece at that time.
Yeah, and so we have to mention the Turks as well. Turkish.
Yes.
Ottoman Turkish. Here's one that surprised me when I found out about it. The word admiral is also...
Yes, I know. Isn't that wild?
Well, so what I found amazing about it is that there are actually a lot of different forms that admiral has taken down the years, and they're based upon different understandings of the etymology of it. So actually, I would say that our word admiral, as we have it now, with that D in it, is influenced most heavily by Latin, admiralis, where from which we get admire. But that word in Latin is probably influenced by the Arabic emir, meaning a commander. And so you also have in English forms that don't have that D that we now have in admiral, which are rather closer to the emir idea of admiral. And people have suggested that the al at the end of admiral is the definite article from Arabic. So it is.
It's been like transposed.
So the emir is commander, and then the al says commander of what? The something. Commander the something. And it was interesting to read what the OED said about that. It said it's not borne out by the textual evidence in either Arabic or Western languages. So basically, there's not a record of the term being shortened to emir al without whatever comes after it. But having said that, there were titles, like there was Amir al-Mu'minim, which meant Commander of the Faithful, which was a title that was assumed by Caliph Omar. But the point is, you can see that you can have that al after the amir.
Yeah, it's unusual. It would sooner be like bin or something like that.
Yeah, I'm not sure about the grammatical implications of it.
You mentioned that the D is Latin influence, right? And the assumption there is that it's related to like admirable. There were a lot of words in English that were ultimately from Latin words beginning with ad, but didn't have the D because it was dropped in Old French like adventure was aventure, and then we put it back.
Okay, you know, I said there are a lot of different versions of admiral in English. Well, another one is a French word, amiraux. The reason there's no D in that version of it that does end up in English as amiraud is just that the French drop the D all the time on those words. It's exactly what you're talking about there. So you can see, actually, if you look down to just, you know, the corpus of the English language since Middle English, when words are coming in from French, you can see so many different spellings of this word, but it's not as arbitrary as varied spellings normally are. The different spellings are influenced by understandings of where that word might have come from.
Did you know that there, it's possible that mafia has a good chunk of Arabic influence, and it might be from an Arabic word? So obviously it is an Italian word. It was a 1875 word for a Sicilian secret society of criminals.
Is it Italian, or is it Sicilian, or what? Because the languages aren't all the same, you know, in these places.
Arabic is often considered the ultimate source, since the Arabs ruled Sicily for a couple centuries in the Middle Ages. But the actual Arabic word that it would come from is, like, no one has found a really good contender. So Sicilian is really what we're looking at, but possibly an Arabic Sicilian word.
Those islands are all kind of interesting, aren't they? Because Malta's like that. Malta speaks English and its own language, which is a curious mix of Arabic and Italian as well.
The source of, like, mafioso could be the Sicilian mafiusu, and then that could possibly have something to do with the Arabic word marfud, meaning rejected or, like, outside of society or something along those lines. But the OED is not like, yes, that, you know?
Okay. Can we go from mafioso to mattress, which is a word from Arabic? Matra, I can't do the pronunciations. I'm really embarrassing myself with these. But it means a place where something is thrown. So something's thrown down, being the implication, like a carpet or something. So a mattress comes from that. It's like it's a thing that you would lay on the floor to get more comfortable, which is very similar to what sofa originally meant, which is, again, from Arabic, shufa, although we get it, I think, from, well, not directly from Turkish. We probably get it from French, I'd have thought. What I like about sofa, while we're on it, is it's a really good example of a Spanish word that ends with an A, but is masculine. That means, hold on, this can't be a native Spanish word. No, it's not. It's not. It comes from the East.
Divan, I believe, is also ultimately Persian and Arabic. The original sense is almost nothing like you would, like a sofa. It was something like a bundle of sheets or a collection of poems. And then the sense changed in Arabic through, like, a book of accounts to a custom house to a council chamber and then to a seat that you would put on them. Like saying, like, the chair of a council or something. Almost the same logic.
To be fair, if you were living in the Ottoman Empire and someone offered you a sofa, you must make sure you don't get your hopes up, because where they're likely to show you is the floor, basically, because the sofa is just a more comfortable bit of the floor to sit on than other bits of the floor.
We have mentioned math and science or math terms before, but I think we should briefly touch on them.
Oh, it's one of the most important things, isn't it? Is the mathematical influence on English. Not least because our numbers are often referred to as Arabic numerals, although Hindu Arabic numerals or Indian Arabic numerals is a little bit more representative of their origins. But those little digits, the symbols that we use to represent our numbers, they do come from Arabic. They're not the
Arabic
same
numerals
as the ones used in Arabic.
Right.
They come from Western Arabic is the way that it tends to be referred to, but which would be the sort of Arabic that might have found its way to Spain, for example. But yeah, our numerals are from Arabic. Why are our numerals from Arabic?
Do tell.
Well, I mean, because, you know, that...
Because they gave us math.
Yeah, exactly. It's the center of the mathematical world. And prior to using Arabic numerals, we're using Roman numerals, which are awful, just awful. For example, you can't add things together very easily. with Roman numerals. You certainly can't multiply things very easily with Roman numerals. You can't put them in little tables in the neat way that you can with Arabic. And that's because Arabic mathematical system is all about the order in which the numbers are placed, right? So if you've got, if you want to represent 1,322, you have one in the thousand column, three in the hundred column, two in the 10 column, and two in the unit column. And that actually is a very good framework around which to do mathematical sums, which is great. But none of that works if you are like the Romans and you do not have a certain number, which is zero, because you need a placeholder to put in when there isn't anything in the hundreds column or in the tens column. And that's why we get zero, because we borrow the concept from Arabic mathematicians. But where do we get the word from?
We get it from sifr, right?
We do. We
get and cipher.
Arabic sifr, yeah, which means empty. It basically means empty, void. The Indian mathematicians are just using a dot, and then that dot turns into a little circle, and that little circle turns into the zero that we know and love. And if you take that sifr and you pass it through various European languages, working your way up north until eventually you get to English, you get zero. But if you take it a little more directly, you get the English word cipher. We should mention who's largely responsible for us getting zero.
Oh, yes.
A certain mathematician whose works are resurrected during the Renaissance, or even earlier than the Renaissance, really, during the medieval period, the sort of late medieval period in Europe. His works, written in the 9th and 10th centuries, I think, suddenly get reread, and everyone in Europe goes, oh my gosh, this is very good way of doing numbers. who's that man?
That's Al-Khwarizmi, the source of the word algorithm.
Yeah, algorithm is from a Latin rendering of his name. His name being the person from Khwarizm. What's the name of the place that he's from?
It's something like that. It's like Da Vinci.
Yeah, exactly.
Same concept. I love the name of his book. We've mentioned it before on this podcast, but I'm going to say it again because it's fun. It's called Al-Kitab al-Muqtasar fi Hisab al-Jabr wal-Muqabala, which means in English, the compendious book on calculation by completion and balancing.
We
need to use the word compendious more in English. Literally means hanging together. This is a compendious friendship.
Penduluming together. If you're getting deja vu, yeah, we did discuss this before when we discussed numbers, but it is worth going. You can't talk about Arabic influence on English without going into this stuff again. And you also can't talk about Al-Khwarizmi without talking about one other mathematical word that he did give us.
Algebra.
Algebra. What does it literally mean?
A reunion of broken parts, to the extent that it was also a word for the process of setting broken bones, even in English, al-jabr.
It's a means of solving quadratic equations, I think, to start with. You remember quadratic equations from school, but now we talk about algebra, we talk about letters replacing numbers and stuff like that. But yeah, it's all from Al-Khwarizmi.
I don't know how common it is now, but apparently Italian, Portuguese, and Catalan have had a medical term, algebrista, which would be like algebraist in English, that still means like bone setter or someone who repositions dislocated bones.
That one man definitely responsible for two words, although one of them he wouldn't have known about, and maybe gets the most credit of any individual for the word zero.
Another mathematical term that I don't know if we discussed in our math-related episode was sine, S-I-N-E, in trigonometry. It's wrong. The Latin word was in Gerardo of Cremona's medieval Latin translation of Arabic geometry publications that took the Arabic jiba, meaning the chord of an arc or the curve of a strung bow and arrow, which he confused with ja'ib, meaning bundle or bosom or fold in a garment, which is also what our word sinus means. It's comparing like foldy, garmenty, curvy things.
Sinus means bosom.
Yeah, also that.
I can see your face, bosoms.
Hopefully not. You'd have to look way up in there. Anyway.
You're in real trouble if someone could see your sinus. Right. Fair point. Mm.
Sinus is used today to refer to those passages in our face that plug up every springtime. The meaning of the Latin sinus was much broader. It meant any fold or bend or curve, including boobs.
When we talk about a sine wave is related to our sinuses.
Though it is supposed to be related to the curve of a bow. Another interesting word that we've addressed this before, and it's mind-blowing every time, I think, is that every sense of the word check comes from the game of chess, which is also from Arabic and Persian. The phrase is shah mat, which came into Arabic from Persian with a twist. In Persian, mat meant to be astonished, and mata meant to die. But mat could also be a declined form of mata, meaning he died. So in Persian, shah mat meant the king or the shah is astonished or left helpless or stumped. Basically, the king literally can't even. but when, when shah even. Mat... So that's what happens when you win chess, right? That's checkmate. So when shah mat came into Arabic, it came into English as checkmate. That mat was mistranslated so that it came to mean the king died. Like checkmate, the word check comes from the game of chess, which is very ancient. The English name of the game was from the old French échecs, meaning chessmen, plural of échec, meaning that the name of the game itself, which came by way of Latin from the Persian Shah or king. And then the original name of the game in Sanskrit was Chaturanga, which referred to the four subdivisions. It had like different armies back then, horses, elephants, chariots, and foot soldiers. And Shah Mat was what you said when you won, just like checkmate today. And then the word échiquier was Old French for check in chess, which was adopted into English as exchequer, originally a word for a chessboard. Exchequer and the word check or check, Q-U-E or C-K, which is the slip of paper you use to move money around, evidently came to be associated with finance and government because in Norman England, people did their accounting on a cloth divided into squares like a chessboard. And then other uses of check, like ticking something off of a list or asking for the check at a restaurant, also appear to have come from this process because counters were placed in certain squares on the cloth to note that the corresponding items had been counted or verified.
Yeah, I think there's also like a less literal transference possible between the idea of the exchequer and the idea of checking, right? As in, you know, calculating something is a way of checking it. And therefore, if you've checked it, you give it a check mark to show that it's been checked. But I do prefer the idea of putting counters on the board.
Right.
I love that one. There is another game that we should mention before we're done. And that is the game of Hazard.
Ah, yes.
Which is a game that I don't think anyone plays anymore, but it's a game that was being played 800 years ago. And the name of it came from French, which had the word hasard.
It's just a dice game, right? Like a chance-based...
It's a dice game. It's got a load of arbitrary rules that make it a little sort of, you know, you've got to get this number, but if you get this number and this number, it means this. And, you know, it's a sort of complex one where I suppose you're relying a lot on luck, which is why the French word for luck is hasard, which means hazard. But the name of the game goes back to al-zahar or zahar, which is Arabic for the die, as in a single dice. I always struggle with that, to remember that one dice is called a die. But that's where our word hazard, it starts with an H, and I think that's a sort of overcorrection that's happened either in English or in French, because there's no reason there should be an H at the start of it. It's, you know, in other languages, it's azar, you know, languages that get that word direct from Arabic. By the time it gets via French into English, it started with a ha that the French are presumably just ignoring anyway. It's there, but they're not pronouncing it. And then it gets into English and we go, oh, but there's an H at the start of it. So let's pronounce the H. So it becomes hazard.
So we've got this sense of risk coming from the dice game, which is cool. And then that D at the end is by influence of my favorite suffix, that A-R-D ending, which is a pejorative.
And again, it'll be potentially an overcorrection, an addition in French, even though it's not pronounced. It just felt like it should be there. And then it gets pronounced in English. I would hazard to guess that we have reached the end of this episode, Jeff.
Yes, there are many more Arabic words in English, but we have no longer have any time to hazard a look at them. So,
well, I feel like my blind spot is slightly less blind now. So thank you very much for enlightening me on much of that. If you can give us any more fascinating facts about Arabic, please do include them in the comments. We will gladly receive them.
We'll see you next time on Words Unraveled.